This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. In this time of great political upheaval, this country lost a formidable force. Maryland Representative Elijah Cummings passed away last week at the age of 68. His legacy is large as an orator, an activist, and someone unafraid to speak truth to power.
When we're dancing with the angels, the question will be asked, in 2019, what do we do to make sure we kept our democracy intact?
Elijah Cummings is believed to become the first African-American lawmaker ever to lie in state in the U.S. Capitol. His legacy is one of the many topics we'll talk about today on Back Channel, our recurring series connecting culture and context. Also going to review Red Table Talk, a show from Jada Pinkett Smith that takes viewers into some of her family's most intimate moments. Plus a new documentary from comedian Chelsea Handler that puts her white privilege front and center. Joining me for all that and more, popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie Bullock Brown is a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at North Carolina State University. Mark Anthony Neal, James B. Duke Professor and Chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University, and author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you here.
What's up, Frank?
Good to have you here.
Let's talk about Elijah Cummings, Maryland Democrat, came from a family of sharecroppers, served more than 20 years in Congress. Natalie, what aspect of his legacy stands out for you?
Well, I found out upon his death that he had gone to Howard University and served as, I think he was the president of the student association there in the early 70s. And, you know, I just thought that that was fitting because as I posted on Instagram on the day that he passed, you know, he first started out serving students and then the rest of us. And I really feel that deeply, that he was not only Baltimore's representative, but that he was absolutely concerned about American citizens as a whole. And you could tell that by the way that he so passionately fought for justice as his, you know, in his post as head of the Oversight Committee. You know, he was formidable. And I think it's kind of a shame that probably along with me that a lot of Americans didn't really know who he was to the extent that we now know. Until he became head of the Oversight Committee. And that was just, you know, as a result of the House flipping. So just last year. And I think that's a shame. But, you know, we certainly lost someone who was on our side.
Yeah, Mark?
The thing about Elijah Cummings is that he wasn't just a politician. He was a politician and he was a race man, right? And he represented a city that in many cases is overwhelmingly black that deserved to have a race man or race woman represent them. And he did that in an extraordinary way, obviously since he got to the House in 1996, but even before then, you know, serving in the Maryland legislature. When you take the pair of himself and his second wife, Maya Rockamore, they were a legit black political power couple. You know, she's the head of the Democratic Party in Maryland now. And what always impressed me about Elijah Cummings, you know, there's a way in which when you become these kind of political figures, you can become kind of lofty and disconnected. But when you see those images of him walking the streets with folks who lived, residents of the city of Baltimore, doing everything that was going on in the aftermath of Freddie Gray's death, you realize this was someone who was also on the ground. It helped that he served someplace that had close proximity to where he worked, mm-hmm. you know, so he could be there in Baltimore in a way that, you know, if you're a congressman from Denver, you wouldn't have that kind of proximity. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that helped him be effective as a legislator, you know, as he was.
And on a number of issues, voting rights, chief among them, in 2016, the Fourth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals struck down provisions of North Carolina's voter ID law, saying it was intentionally designed to discriminate against black people and black voters, and that the North Carolina legislature had drafted a law that would target African Americans with almost surgical precision, unquote. Now, here's Elijah Cummings commenting on that language.
The reason why that quote means so much to me is that 1 year ago today, on my mother's dying bed at 92 years old, former sharecropper, her last words were, "Do not let them take our votes away from us." This is not Russia. This is the United States of America.
Late Democratic Congressman Elijah Cummings talking on C-SPAN in 2016. It was actually during a committee hearing. And I'm talking about his legacy today on Back Channel, a recurring series connecting culture and context. When I listen to his rhetoric, it reminds me of the rhetoric that politicians used to use. And it really is about American values. It isn't about my side. Here are the ideological talking points of the Democratic Party, which is what you hear now, or ideological talking parts of the Republican Party or Donald Trump, whatever comes out of the White House. They are definitely sided. They have their own morality, and they never appeal to the broader kind of American instinct or moral values. And Cummings always did. He always kept talking about what makes us American.
I mean, that's one of the things you heard in the last year or so around the immigration crisis, particularly what was happening to children. That great scene where, you know, he basically says to the president about what's happening to these children, come on, man.
Where
is your humanity? Right. And I think you speak that to a throwback era almost, right, where for everybody believed in this idea that the idea of America was bigger than your political party, even if you had political differences.
Yeah. I was just going to add that, you know, the way that Cummings comes across, it almost seems old-fashioned,
yeah.
right, because
yeah.
it doesn't really, as you said, appeal to, like, sort of the bipartisan ways that we talk about politics. But he's absolutely, I mean, that is probably exactly where we need to go back to, is this not so much middle of the road, but where we are focused on the issues and what is best for the majority of Americans,
right.
instead of, you know, picking our ideological sides.
Well, core values that speak to an American republic and whatever ideals that we have invented about ourselves, let's all pretend we believe them and address them, and not the core ideals of one party or the other, which, you're right. I mean, it's a throwback. I want to turn our attention now to the story of a Tatiana Jefferson, 28-year-old woman killed earlier this month inside her own home when a Fort Worth police officer shot her through the window of her house where she was playing a video game with her 8-year-old nephew. The officer resigned from the department. He has been charged with murder. Natalie, what was your reaction?
My reaction was horror. I mean, literally the day after I found out about Tatiana's death, the way that our house in Raleigh is situated, we're up against trees in the back, so we don't really have blinds. We just have curtains that are basically open. And I had to fight with myself to not go there in terms of being afraid of what could possibly happen. Just because we have great neighbors, you know, the neighbors look out for each other. In Tatiana's case, her neighbor was looking out for her and she ended up dead. And I just feel like, you know, that could happen to me. So I felt all kinds of things. And no matter how you slice it, it's just wrong. I mean, there's no reason why this young woman is no longer with us. Just none.
It's been a decade since Oscar Grant was killed in Oakland. And the fact that 10 years later, that we can still be as enraged and as surprised by some of these shootings, just speaks volumes about where we are around over-policing and all kinds of issues. Now, and of course, this particular case in Dallas-Fort Worth, you know, Tatiana's death is part of a larger culture of over-policing that is problematic. You know, so you have a neighbor who's concerned about the well-being of another neighbor. Dispatch gets a call about, can you do a well check on this house? You could imagine officers who saying, well, there's never well checks in Black communities, right? This must be something that we're going to have to deal with. And rather just simply knock on the door. The lights are on in the living room and say hello. Because first of all, if anybody's robbing the house 3 o'clock in the morning, the lights aren't going to be on.
Exactly. Right.
But rather than do the humane thing, the normal, the sensible thing to knock on the door, let's go around the dark in the back, right? Tell you to raise your hands, not even give you a chance to respond and in 4 seconds shoot. You know, we could talk about the individual in this case maybe being racist, but we also have to talk about the training and the presumed criminality that clearly goes through this police force about who and what Black people are.
Well, and you talk about the number of cases over the number of years where police training and police implicit bias and explicit bias has been the problem. New York Times looked at what's been going on in Fort Worth and documented ongoing, long-simmering tensions. Atiana became the sixth person to be killed by Fort Worth police since June. Four of the six are black. So there's a problem in Fort Worth Police Department that nobody has addressed, even with one story after another. Wouldn't you look at your department and say?
And honestly, had Botham Jean not been killed a year ago and had his shooter not recently been convicted, I don't think there's any chance in hell that this particular officer would have been fired and indicted as quickly as he was.
Yeah, well, and he resigned, right? You know,
resigned before he was fired.
Before he was fired, but he has been indicted. He's
quickly
been charged.
Right.
Yeah. But you know, the other thing that I think is really important to say about this case is that it just makes, I think, if black folks weren't already at the point where they're like, you know what, I'm good. I'm not going to call the police. If I need help, I'm going to call somebody else. This is the type of thing that makes you just say, you know what, I will figure it out. We'll just have to duke it out to the death, but we are not calling the police because we don't know what will happen.
Because one of the things that New York Times piece pointed out, the number of times where black folks have actually called the police for help and they became the targets.
Yes. Yeah.
Mark Anthony Neal, James B. Duke, professor and chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke. Natalie Bullock Brown, filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State. It's Back Channel today on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And there's more to come. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. One of Hollywood's most famous families is using Facebook to invite the public into some of their raw and intimate conversations. In Red Table Talk, Jada Pinkett Smith, along with her mother and her daughter, invite celebrities into their family home to talk about taboo topics, including substance abuse, infidelity, and porn. And the show is striking a chord. It won an NAACP Image Award, garnered an Emmy nomination, and is watched by millions of people. With me to talk about that in our recurring series, Back Channel, are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie's a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State. Mark Anthony Neal is James B. Duke professor and chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke. Let's start with a clip from a recent episode of Red Table Talk to give us a sense of what it is we're talking about. And here, in this particular episode, they are talking with musician Alicia Keys.
It's been so interesting that I've become known for songs that are very empowering
yes,
for women.
Right.
I realize now that the times that I've written those songs are the times that I've needed those songs.
Yeah, that makes total sense.
Yeah. It was usually at times where I felt so unstrong, so unsuperwomanly, so weak or confused or feeling misunderstood, that the only way that I knew how to get through that was to write what I was hoping for.
Yeah. That's really powerful, though, because it's almost like medicine. Yeah. Not only medicine for you, but medicine
for
us.
Other people.
You know? Even when I'm a mess, I still put on a vest with an S on my chest. Yes. Oh, yes, I'm a superwoman.
Yes!
Because I'm a mess, y'all. I'm a mess.
But that's the thing. We are.
Musician Alicia Keys on the Facebook Watch show Red Table Talk, hosted by Jada Pinkett Smith, Smith's mother, Adrienne Banfield Jones, and her daughter, Willow Smith. Talking about it today on Back Channel. Natalie, what do you think?
You know, the thing that I think is remarkable about it is that it's free. You know, you can look at every single episode that they've ever done. And it's earnest. And one of the things that I just have to say about Jada Pinkett Smith, like when it first started, I was like, okay, like what is this going to be? How's this going to work? I really appreciate what she has built over the years with this show. I think it is a space where people get to, you know, really kind of let their hair down and talk about things. And she is so honest and authentic. At least she comes across that way, that, you know, she really sort of sets a really wonderful tone. And the conversations are amazing. I mean, the one with Alicia Keys that we just played a clip from was, I thought, so insightful and interesting because I learned things about Alicia Keys that I would not have thought are true about her, but I also could really relate to what they were talking about in general. So I think it's a really wonderful vehicle, and the fact that it's accessible in the way that it is, I think, is amazing.
Yeah. Mark?
I feel the same way. You know, we could have our qualms, as we should, with Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
But for all the evils of Facebook, it has allowed for modes of communication that, you know, this is not something that she would have been able to do on a network program.
Right.
You know, and so she's able to have some sort of editorial control over it because she's Jada Pinkett Smith and because she's been so raw.
Right.
Where for her own experiences and her family's experiences, everyone else is willing to come sit at the table and be raw, too.
Yeah.
Let's talk about their celebrity status. They're one of the biggest families in Hollywood, one of the biggest families in the world, right? I mean, in terms of their status, when you think about before social media, what could a big star do if they wanted to make a difference? They could spend a lot of money, start a foundation. But this really does engage people in a conversation in ways that, you know, as you say, you're, even if you're a big star, you're not going to get a network TV show like this. Right?
And this seems to be very in line with who Jada is. I mean, this is Jada's show. Like, let's be clear. It's not Will's show. Mm-hmm. It's Jada's. And I think her imprimatur is very solid. It's deep in the space that she's created. And I think that that's a part of what makes it appealing, because while she has this, you know, what kind of feels like a past, like her career is in the past in many ways, this has made her so incredibly relevant, you know, that... I don't know, if she never did another, you know, movie, I think she's doing something that is pulling in millennials, it's pulling in a younger generation, but it's also appealing to those of us who grew up watching her.
And there's a real sense of authenticity. I'm always reminded of that joke, how do you be a success in Hollywood? Sincerity. If you can fake that, you got it made. So the joke keeps spinning in my head, but you feel it when you watch it. There's a space to talk about some of the most personal issues. There was an episode from last year where Willow revealed to her mother and grandmother that she had been self-harming with cutting for a period of time. And Jada Pinkett Smith was talking about that moment in an interview with Trevor Noah. And Trevor Noah says, hey, I felt to me like you learned that on the show. And she said, I did.
Why did you leave that in? I mean, that's such a vulnerable moment.
Willow wanted me to.
Wow.
I asked her, I said, are you sure that, you know, you want to talk about this and on this platform? And she said she thought it was really important. And she was right, because even young people who were in our family that were going through it,
right,
felt like they could now come out and tell us because Willow had talked about it. And there were so many young people that reached out and felt like they could talk about it now because Willow had. And inside, I'm like, so many feelings are happening. I want to cry. I want to scream. I'm like, how could I not know? But in that moment, I had to remove that parent ego. It was a teachable moment for me in understanding that we can't be there for our children sometimes in their darkest hours, but our love is always there.
Jada Pinkett Smith talking on The Daily Show with Trevor Noah about her Facebook Watch show, the Red Table Talk, and I'm talking about it on Back Channel Today with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. So these moments come through, and it does inspire other people to come forward and generate a conversation.
Yeah, I think there's something about the Smith family, just the way that at least I've watched and observed them raise their children, that I think comes through on this show as well. Because, I don't know how many other celebrities would necessarily pull in their teenage daughter and their mom for a conversation. And I think they seem to be the type of family that is very open, that talks about everything, and that is, you know, allows people to be who they are. And I think that that is a part of the appeal of the show, that you see that in the relationships that are at the base of the show, but also in the way that they relate to their guests.
Now, Mark, it just has to be said that one of the things that apart from that little joke that goes through my head now and then as I watch the show, is knowing what Facebook is up to. They're data mining, and they are reading the comments, and they're using, and they're pretty transparent about that, that this is the perfect vehicle to get people to talk about the most vulnerable, scary things in their lives. Can't Facebook use that? That does a little troubling.
I think that's always been the trade-off for Black cultural workers, in particular around popular culture and having to use mainstream culture to do that work. You realize that it's an exploitive process, right? But at the same time, if you're able to do very good work around it, it's important. You know, the episode when Kristen Davis comes on to talk about transracial adoption, and it's a perfect opportunity on the one hand to pat a white woman on the back for doing things that we might presume is kind of exceptional, but they don't do that with her.
Yeah, we have a clip from that very show.
How has raising Black children made you more aware of white privilege?
This is what I want to say from a white person adopting. You absolutely do not fully understand. There's no doubt. There's no way you could.
Right. Yeah.
Because you could understand that you live in white privilege and that's a theory and you could see things.
Right.
But it's one thing to be watching it, you know, happening to other people. And it's another thing when it's your child.
Yes.
And you haven't personally been through it.
That is very interesting, okay? Because it's when you're looking at situations, specifically racism happening on the outside, but then now you have this child,
right,
who is your own. Now you have to confront prejudices, biases, racism in a whole different way.
I don't know how every person of color has gotten through this. I don't understand.
Yeah.
How you could take this every day.
Every day.
Actress Kristen Davis on the Facebook Watch show Red Table Talk, co-hosted by Jada Pinkett Smith, her mother Adrienne Banfield Jones and daughter Willow Smith, Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. So that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things I appreciate about that episode in particular, as an adoptive father, one of the things that the daughter and mother, you know, recognize is that, you know, African American adoption typically takes place in non-formal contexts. Mm-hmm. One of the things the episode does is actually make the point that, in fact, more African Americans need to be involved in more traditional forms of adoption, particularly if folks are going to complain about white people who are adopting Black kids, right? Because the one thing you can say about a Kristen Davis and many other of these white folks is that they decided to be at the table, right? And this is not that Black folks don't do that kind of heavy lifting in these kind of off-the-grid kind of ways. But in terms of more traditional forms of adoption, you know, we need to see more African-Americans engage in that process.
It's refreshing to hear someone like Kristen Davis actually own up to the fact that she doesn't get it. And I don't think that we would hear her say that on The View or The Chew or any of the other talk shows.
Or she wouldn't have been asked.
Right. Well, there you go.
right.
Exactly.
Well, it does two things, too, right? I mean, so because, you know, we've created this kind of intimate space where people are going to talk more deeply and then about their personal experience, but it also creates this world that we keep talking about, you know, in media circles, like, can't we all have this conversation? Like, unless we learn to talk together and talk these things out in an uncomfortable environment, none of these issues are going to get worked out. So at the very least, it's a model for that kind of thing, right?
I have to say that I think that Jada and her and Willow and her mom have grown, certainly, as the show has. And that these conversations have actually deepened their analysis about the very things that they're talking about. So I feel more and more compelled to watch and to hear what not only their guests are going to say, but what they have to say as well, because there's a lot of insight there.
Let's talk now about the Netflix special from Chelsea Handler. It's called Hello Privilege, It's Me, Chelsea. Natalie, remind us who Chelsea Handler is and a bit about this her stuff.
Well, I didn't know who she was until I saw the show on Netflix. But Chelsea Handler is a comedian. And so Chelsea decided, you know, after achieving a level of success and fame, that she wanted to be a good white ally. And she wanted to go out into the world and do a documentary about white privilege. And the result is, Hey Privilege, It's Me, Chelsea.
So a 60-minute special exploring the concept of white privilege through a series of conversations with white and Black folk. One of the ones, at one point she meets three Republican women in an affluent part of Orange County, California, and here's part of that conversation.
My take on the white privilege thing is, I mean, if we're going to say there's white privilege, then you would have to say that there's some form of privilege for any race or any gender, any religion. I mean, I don't know if privilege is the right word.
Do you think Black people have privilege?
In every race, like
have,
I said, in every
what kind of privilege do people of color get?
They get college admission now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's kind of a big one.
That's a big
one.
They,
a certain percentage have to be hired.
You think that's wrong?
Not that that's wrong, but to really feel like you need to hire someone based on their skin color, it seems wrong.
Isn't it kind of the right thing to do to say, hey, let's give people who we were oppressing for so long a little bit of a head start, a little bit of an opportunity since we've all benefited from those opportunities? I definitely think I've benefited from the color of my skin. I don't think I would have gotten away with my career if I were a black girl.
Part of me thinks it's time to move on and knock it off and quit talking about it.
No, well, first you have to admit that something happened.
But we've come so far in America.
Clip from the new Chelsea Hunter Netflix special. Hello, Privilege. It's me, Chelsea. I'm talking about it on Back Channel with Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown.
So I've been watching Chelsea Handler in many different contexts for about 10 years. You know, she had a late night show for a long time, and she always kind of trafficked in her knowledge of black culture and people of color culture. So whether it was her sidekick, quote unquote sidekick, who was a Latino man, you know, she had a very public relationship with 50 Cent. And so I'm sure at some point she thought she was someone who didn't have to raise these kinds of questions. But this is the other part of white privilege. The other part of white privilege is that you can go to Netflix and say, I want to make a series about white privilege that is largely about centering myself in this conversation about white privilege and not necessarily doing any real labor around dispensing with and eradicating, you know, white privilege.
Right. And that is the problem with the documentary. I do appreciate the fact that Chelsea goes and does some self-reflection and, you know, goes and has these conversations because in some instances they're quite interesting. But, you know, in one of the scenes in the documentary, she goes to University of Southern California to this poetry slam held by a lawyer at USC. And, you know, one of the students is like, I'm really embarrassed to be here with you, actually, because, you know, this to me is the height of white privilege. Just like Mark said, that you are here asking these questions, trying to learn from us black people so that you can understand better what your privilege is. You know, I want to know, what are you going to do? Like, after the documentary is over, what are you willing to give up?
Yeah, but doesn't she have to where does she start if she doesn't start there?
You know, I get that, but there's so much of it that seems self-indulgent. It really comes down to Chelsea Handler saying, I don't want to feel bad anymore about people accusing me of being racist or potentially racist, right? That's what the hour-long film. Now, of course, if she had a chance to do 8 episodes for 8 hours and actually talk to some experts, you know, one of the things that bothered me very early on, right, she wanted to talk to experts about race and white privilege, and she sits down with Kevin Hart and Tiffany Haddish, right, who have no better understanding of what white privilege is themselves, but then they get centered as the experts in this conversation. And then the first time you actually see an expert, it's not anybody black, it's Tim Wise, the white expert on white privilege.
Yeah.
Well, let's take another clip, and let's listen. This is a clip from Hello Privilege. The documentary also confronts her own past, as you say, front and center. There she is. But she does go to meet up with her former high school boyfriend, Tyshawn, who has spent 14 years in prison.
And so, wait, how long? I thought you've been out of jail for 14 years.
No, 3 years.
Oh, 3 years.
I was in jail for 14 years.
You were in jail for 14 years.
Yes.
So I can't believe you were in prison for 14 years for what?
We don't even want to talk about it. That was for armed robbery.
You got in trouble a lot when we were together, and I was always not able to skirt out of the trouble.
That's right.
Like, I remember getting pulled over like 4 or 5 times on my way home to the house when I had been drinking. I had like 5 people in the car, and every single time I got through it.
No, but you had the complexion for the connection.
Wow, I was in some pretty hairy situations that I never, ever paid the price for.
Never.
That's a clip from Hello Privilege. It's me, Chelsea.
The reason why I think we're laughing is because Chelsea in this scene she's kind of trying to piece it together, but her boyfriend is just like, yeah, I knew this back when we were dating. I knew you were getting off from getting into trouble or, you know, have anything happening to you that was happening to me because you're white. You know, and the way that Chelsea talks about that time in her life, it's almost like it's a medal. Look at me. I used to date a drug dealer when I was white and I'm Jewish. You know, I used to, and I moved in with them. So it's like a badge of honor for her. But then at the same time, she takes a lot of time to talk about how her family basically ripped her out of, you know, Tashan's house because, you know, you're on the wrong path and we got to get you straight and you're going down the wrong road and all of this. So I'm not really sure what she's trying to say. And in a lot of ways, it makes the documentary offensive. But, you know, again, she is trying to have some sort of conversation that white people do need to have, but they need to have it with themselves. They do not need to involve black people because we have done enough educating. We really have.
And so it's that alloy, I think, that I'm hearing here, because the revelation seems to be an interesting thing. It's like, isn't that what we want us to come to? Say, oh, my goodness, I never realized that. So you kind of want that part, but you're saying the way it's framed.
Because she liked black men, right? She thought she thought that was rebellious enough to protect her from the critiques of white supremacy, and it's not, right? And she's in this moment of discovery, right? And anybody who comes to this new kind of consciousness around race, that moment of discovery is all about you, right? You know, so I don't want to set her aside and say that she's unusual in this regard in terms of it being so self-indulgent, but if it doesn't translate into additional work, right, including some of this in her stand-up, right, in whatever platform she's using, right, if she doesn't take this moment of discovery and apply it to stuff that actually is applicable and can impact lives, just in the people around her, her staff.
And I totally agree with Mark. I hope that Chelsea will continue to have these conversations, but have them not go out and find black people to educate her or to have the conversation with. Only white people can do that. They can only appeal to each other. And so I hope she will continue to do that work.
Natalie Bullock Brown, filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State. Mark Anthony Neal, a professor and chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke. It's Back Channel, and we will continue with taking a look at the new Netflix superhero Raising Dion when we return. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. It's Back Channel today, our recurring series connecting culture and context. And I'm here with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie's a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State. Mark is a James B. Duke professor and chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke. We're going to turn now to Tyler Perry, the noted actor, producer, director, and now the first African American to own a major movie studio. Officially opened Tyler Perry Studios earlier this month. Features 12 massive sound stages, more than 300 acres of a filming complex. Let's start now with a clip of him talking about this particular piece of land that he buys on a former Confederate Army base.
The property that slaves built that was once a Confederate Army base. Think about the poetic justice in that. The Confederate Army is fighting to keep Negroes enslaved in America, fighting, strategy, planning on this very ground. And now this very ground is owned by me.
Tyler Perry talking about Tyler Perry Studios on CBS this morning. It's a 330-acre movie sound complex in Atlanta. Opened earlier this month. I'm talking to Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie. Tyler Perry.
Well, it is an amazing thing that Tyler Perry has opened these studios that rival Hollywood studios in Atlanta. From all appearances, the gala that sort of marked the beginning of the opening of the studios was star-studded. I think Will Smith has his own studio. Denzel Washington has his own studio. Oprah Winfrey does. You know, Tyler Perry is absolutely the embodiment of whatever is left of the American dream. He has certainly come from being homeless and really having, according to his story, you know, his own words, having nothing, to building this empire. And so that is absolutely to be applauded. It is so interesting to me at the same time that, you know, Tyler is talking about this land that he purchased and that it was built by slaves with the intent by the Confederate Army to keep black folks, you know, in slavery. And Madea, I mean, that's all, I mean, that's where I gotta, you know, I gotta put that in there, because yeah. Madea is essentially doing the same type of work. And even though he's retired her, apparently, mm-hmm. that's what he says. He turned 50 and he retired her.
Yeah, well, let's talk a little bit about who Madea is, because maybe not everybody's seen those films. Madea is a character. Tyler Perry plays the character of a woman, African-American woman.
Yes, and in the spirit of Flip Wilson and Geraldine mm-hmm. and many other characters, it's, you know, Tyler Perry cross-dressing as a woman who, in some way, despite her interesting use of the English language and questionable moral choices, mm-hmm. In many ways is this embodiment of a black respectability politics, right? And he's built his empire on this character and making films that didn't cost a whole lot of money to make but generate a lot of profit. This is the thing, though. You know, Tyler Perry is not our ancestors' wildest dreams. And in the same context that he talks about having a studio that existed on land where African-American enslaved toiled, he chose to build a studio in Atlanta so that he can use non-unionized labor.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
right. So first of all, let's be very clear about that. Mm-hmm. You know, Tyler Perry is not by any means stretch a good filmmaker. The fact that he's actually a better actor than he is a filmmaker says a great deal mm-hmm. about how bad of a filmmaker he is. That being said, he is not only a gifted businessman, he's a shrewd businessman. All right. So the fact that he could take one of his most public critics and Spike Lee and name a studio after Spike Lee so that he never has to hear another mumbling word from Spike Lee about his films. Like, Spike had to show up and take selfies with Tyler Perry.
But what
because
about,
there's a studio after.
All right, but let's talk about that brilliance for just a moment. Let's talk about that genius for and, you know, his rags-to-riches story. I don't know that anybody's disputed it. It's an incredible tale. Where he then begins writing this character, and he puts it on the stage and is doing pretty well, and then he makes these cheap movies that aren't good movies, but everybody watches them. There's a genius there. Let's let him talk about the character Madea, because, you know, that's the one that made him. Here he is talking about Diary of a Mad Black Woman. It's a 2005 film that inspired the play of the same name, and it features the Madea character.
No, I always did it from day one, Diary of a Mad Black Woman. They thought Diary of a Mad Black Woman would do $20 million the entire movie, and it opened past that. So there's a clear disconnect. When they try to track my audience, they don't know how to really get to them. Black women, when they are with you, they're like country music fans. Nobody can take them away from you. So, and they've been with me all these years, and I'm grateful for every moment of it.
I mean, is there a kind of a Vox Populi, Vox Dei moment here where the people have spoken, Mark, you and your other critics? Just get out the way.
I'm not as... I'm not as critical as Natalie might be.
And I'm a black woman.
Of Madea.
That's right.
And the one thing I will say is that if you look at just his body of work, there's a consistency with the Madea films that they're actually are much better made. You know, there's a kind of sensibility about them that you can tap into. But this is the thing. You know, as much as we would like to be woke, no one can be woke 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you know, 12 months a year. When we see the way black folks appreciated and watched and listened to Amos and Andy, listened to in the 30s and 40s, watched in the 1950s, what you realize is that sometimes black folks just want to laugh at themselves, right? And if anything, Tyler Perry understood that. And particularly black church folks wanting to laugh at themselves, right? There were so very few spaces. Right. In the culture. Right. You'd actually have to go back to think about like a show like Amen in the early 90s and literally like some of Flip Wilson's kind of church skits, you know, mm-hmm. when it was on the Flip Wilson mm-hmm. show. Right. So he understood there was an audience for this. I don't think he even had an idea that it would be as successful and transcendent, you know, as it has become.
Yeah. You know, but we go back to this word representation. Right. I mean, there are so few opportunities for black people to see themselves in any sort of way. And Tyler Perry continually has been churning out these films that show black folks that we know. I mean, I know folk like Madea, right? I mean, everybody probably does. And so that is the magic, I guess, of what Tyler Perry does. And I would say, you know, I don't know that I completely agree with Mark. I think that Tyler has put out a couple of films that I think are noteworthy. And his For Color Girls, I think, was actually very well done.
We're going to disagree
on that. Okay, we can disagree on that. But, you know, the Madea one is, I just don't want him to perpetuate stereotypes about black women when black women are his fans.
And you're not a country music fan, I'm guessing.
And I am
so
not.
There you go, twice. Let's turn now to the review of new music from Grammy-winning pianist and composer Robert Glasper. We can't say the full name of this new album on the radio, but it is F Yo Feelings. And we're going to start by listening to one of the tracks now. We can't play any of the music on this.
Right now.
There's an F sharp that we can play.
Right.
That's it. The rest of it. No, here it is. Endangered Black Women featuring Andra Day and Stacey Ann Chin.
Why are everybody's needs more urgent than my own? When do we worry about me? My feelings, my needs, my rights, my body, my safety, my life. When do we begin to center the endangered black woman? I'm thinking the time is now. I'm saying the time is now. Not tomorrow, not next week, not next year. I say we begin here, now, today, this minute. I'm saying your cowardice, indifference, your hesitation. My time is now. My feelings are now. Make time for them. Make space for them. Deal with your race, your gender, sexuality. Now, before we set fire to everything we take care of for you, set fire to everything and watch the whole lot of it.
From the song Endangered Black Woman from Robert Glasper's new album.
I'm kind of chuckling because I'm imagining Chris Matthews from MSNBC asking Stacey Ann Chin, so are you mad at white people? Are you angry at white people? Like he asked Kamala Harris that. Are you going to burn us down? I mean, you know, Robert Glasper is irreverent. I mean, to the extent that he has just kind of flipped straight ahead jazz on its head with the different experimentations that he has been doing over the years. So this to me feels like just a progression in terms of what he has been doing. I'm not sure that it works all the time, but what I love about it is that he's willing to take the risk. He's willing to experiment. He's willing to pull in a lot of people that he often collaborates with, like Yasiin Bey, and which is Mos Def, and Bilal. These are R&B singers and rappers, but he also brings in people like Rhapsody. And Andra Day, and Herbie Hancock is on the album. So there's some really interesting collaborating going on.
Glasper is one of the most visible and successful jazz artists of the post-Marsalis generation. He came up, and he's also of this generation that came of age listening to hip-hop. And I think he's always been torn between the stuff that made him recognizable to a Blue Note Records audience and the stuff that he wanted to do. And clearly over the last couple of years, he's pivoted more towards whether it's the Black Radio Projects, which is really about getting certain kinds of jazz on the radio on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. And he's, I think, conscious of the fact that this is a risky endeavor. You know, hence he calls it an EP. But he's also, or mixtape rather, but he's also responding to certain kind of critical sensibilities. Like, he got into a lot of trouble last year talking about his relationship or lack of a relationship with Lauryn Hill. There are a lot of folks who critiqued him as being sexist and misogynist, as kind of an extension of how jazz has functioned that way. And I think he was very conscious, like on a song like Endangered Species or Endangered Women, you know, to have very strong feminist voices, particularly in Stacey Ann Chin, as a way to buttress this critique of who he is, right? So I think he's also doing some gamesmanship here, you know, in the context of this recording.
Expectations too. I mean, there are several songs on the mixtape that speak to what Mark is talking about. So there's a lot of stuff going on, which is interesting because if he is doing gamesmanship, it's ironic that the album is titled what it is, because you would think that he would not care.
Well, I want to turn now our attention to the last topic in Netflix superhero sci-fi show Raising Dion. This is a Netflix, as I say, a sci-fi show Raising Dion about a young boy with superpowers as his mother begins to realize that. I want to play a clip from the show.
I'm telling you, okay, something is happening with Dion. I mean, I was bleeding. I mean, look at my shoulder.
So you're saying Dion's violent? I'm saying he has powers, okay? Weird, scary powers.
You have a lot going on right now.
Don't do that. Don't minimize.
I'm not trying to minimize. I'm trying to figure out what's going on because I can tell you right now, Dion does not have powers.
Just come back in there. I can show you.
No! Stop it, okay? You're acting nuts. You don't get to do this anymore, Nicole. You're somebody's mother, for God's sake.
You don't think that I know that?
You need to get it together.
A scene from the new Netflix sci-fi superhero show Raising Dion. Talk more about the premise of the show, Natalie.
So it is a show that Michael B. Jordan, who most people will know as Killmonger from Black Panther.
Or Creed.
Or Creed, right. So he executive produced this series for Netflix, and he plays the role of a father whose son is determined to have supernatural powers, and this is after Michael's character dies. He's a scientist, a storm chaser, and apparently dies in the midst of what I'm assuming is Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah. There are a couple of things I love about this series. First of all, to deal with Michael B. Jordan's character, who, by the way, is named Mark. And you understand when the series starts that he's dead, right? And you just assuming all kinds of context. You know, he was hood rat. You know, he got shot, police brutality. And you find out that he was a storm chaser. And I'm like, I have never heard of a Negro storm chaser before in my life, right? So already it's playing with our kind of sensibilities, right? The fact that you had a Black man, in this case a Black couple, that felt free enough just to explore and not being written into certain kinds of scripts. And it plays out in the context of the series, you know, in her conversations with her sister, who's a medical doctor, right? And this kind of idea that the mother now needs to straighten up and fly right, if you will. The other thing that I think is important, we're thinking about a superhero character, that superhero powers don't keep you from a state of precarity, right? This is a child, you know, who has a mother who has to find this balance between taking care of her son, keeping an eye on him because of extraordinary powers, but also needs to go out and get a job.
Right. She doesn't have superpowers, but she has super authority. So she's got all the authority and none of the power. And here's a kid who can, like, blow up a room, and he doesn't always want to.
Yeah, and just like the Netflix series, that the name of which I cannot remember, but, you know, this is like superhero while being Black, right? Because all of the issues that exist within the Black universe come to bear pretty much in this series. The little boy who's, 8 years old? I mean, he gets accused of hitting another little kid who steals his watch, and that's a whole, you know, story right there. But it's because he's Black that he is, you know, suspended and treated differently. The mom trying to find a job, not really being given, she's given a chance, but she's got to bring her son with her to the job interview. Right. Like, how many, I know about that, I can raise my hand. So that type of, you know, just the experience of being a Black mother and even a Black child, in spite of these superpowers, you still have to deal with the realities of being Black.
And that's why I think it's important, right? You know, when Natalie says superhero while Black and not living in Wakanda, right, where you're protected by a certain kind of... I mean, we see the same dynamic in Black Lightning where your superpowers don't protect you from the reality of what race looks like in America, particularly as a Black family.
Yep. Mark Anthony Neal, James B. Duke Professor and Chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke, an author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Natalie Bullock Brown, a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State University. Thank you both. We've done it again.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you for listening to Back Channel on the State of Things. We've got it all on our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Grant Hall of Mormon. Robin Copley is our technical director, Josie Taras, our intern. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.